And now, it's time for the talk of the Northwest. The 9 to Noon Show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello, good morning to you. You're very welcome along to the 9 to Noon Show here on Highland Radio. It's Thursday's edition of the programme, of course, and it's a nice one. We've got some really good stuff coming up for you on the programme today. We have a long conversation or a sit-down chat with Ian McGarvey and his significant other as well. I'm looking forward to having them in studio to talk about their milestone they celebrated together and reflect on their life together as well. That and so much more besides. Get involved in this conversation, please, or in fact, trigger your own. The WhatsApp and text number is 086 60 25000, 086 60 25000, or give us a call on 07491 25000. And if you want to email, it's comments at highlandradio.com. We're streaming for you on X, Highland Radio there. Search it out on Facebook, Highland Hub, Highland News and Sport. And you can watch the show as well on YouTube, on your smart TV or your Fire Stick, if that suits you, wherever you are and if you are at home. So we had a fantastic day yesterday, as I mentioned to Lee. We were down at Aras an Uachtaráin, a rare treat. And as I say, I've been really lucky this week. It's a pretty quiet summer from here on. But we got to meet, obviously, Michael D. Higgins, his wife, all of their crew. We were really well looked after. It was like a set up as a garden party. And there were lots of people from all over the country involved with local radio. And it was part of Irish Music Month. You might remember last year we ran a competition here, and it was Charles James and The Rise that won that competition. They went forward and represented us really, really well. They went forward and, represented us really, really well. Unfortunately, didn't win out on the day. They were represented there. James O'Donnell, he is in Angola. He wasn't there, unfortunately, but his wonderful partner Catherine was there, and wee baby Meave, who was the youngest person at the event there from Donegal, which is great, and they were there with mum stroke granny as well. Lovely to chat to them, and it was great to see them as well. And they were the fella that won that competition, actually, is doing really, really well at the moment. And he is supporting Billy Joel in London during his tour in the next coming weeks. So isn't that fantastic? So that competition is going to be opened again, I think, in September. So just to let you know that great success comes from it. So if you have any musicians in your life, or if indeed you are a musician, keep an ear out to Highland Radio, because there is a wonderful opportunity coming up later in the year. And we got to meet some brilliant people as well. As I mentioned to Lee Gooch, some really down-to-earth people. Gavin James was there, as I mentioned. Or did I mention that? I can't remember their names, actually. Let me see. Who was there? Yeah, Gavin James was there. He was brilliant. Dermot Kennedy, he's an excellent performer. And there's a young guy there too, Shobsy, S-H-O-B-S-Y, who is unbelievable. He really is absolutely a fantastic vocalist and performer as well. I've no doubt he's going to go on to really, really big things. But it was really nice. And I can't remember the exact phraseology, but the member of the armed forces that sort of is the assistant to, or the chaperone, or whatever the phraseology is an O'Donnell from Falkara. I can't remember his first name just off the top of my head. I was told, but the top guy there that looks after President D. Higgins is O'Donnell from Falkara. His name will come back to me, or someone will text it into me who was there and listening. I didn't get a chance to speak to him, but the Donegal connections run very, very deep down there as well. So it was a lovely, lovely day and a really pleasant drive. We got back about 2 o'clock, but nice and fresh, good night's sleep, and here we are. Right, okay, let's go on to the newspapers this morning. The Tyrconnell Tribune. Fianna Fáil members in Donegal have been put on a general election alert, with confirmation that nominations for the selection convention are now open, but not for very long. Nominations will close on Monday, July the 15th at 5 p.m. Already there is speculation about their plan to win back their lost seat in Donegal South West in 2020. However, a party insider said, "We'll be damned lucky to hold what we have already." I don't agree with that. Micheál Nocton is going to run. I can tell you that for a fact. I don't know it is for a fact, but I can tell you for a fact Micheál Nocton is going to run in South Donegal. And he's very, very popular. He did very, very well in the local elections. He's got a good rep down there, and he's got a big hinterland to draw votes from. I really see sort of the Fianna Fáil seat that was in West Donegal, you know, through Pat the Cope and what have you. It's shifting eastwards and southwards to the south of the county. There's a massive there is a massive Fianna Fáil vote in that area, and I think Micheál Nochtain stands a very good chance of winning that seat. And if I had €1 million, I would put 950,000 on Micheál Nochtain standing for Fianna Fáil in that area. That's how confident I am that he will be. And I'm sure it's probably already been decided, if the truth be told, because those conversations happen locally, of course, but there's meetings happening on a national level whereby expressions of interest and conversations you can be sure are happening. And as I say, I'm not a betting person, but if Micheál Nochtain doesn't run for Fianna Fáil in that part of the county, unless something happens, a fallout or something along those lines, I would eat my hat. And I think you'd do really quite well down there as well. The Derry People, Donegal News this morning. Residents in Letterkenny are calling for clarity in the wake of lodged plans to change the use of a residential house into a guest house. Up to 150 residents packed into Bonagie Hall recently to air their concerns about the proposed plans ahead of formally lodging an objection with the planning authority. Applicant Sean Harris submitted planning permission proposals to Donegal County Council on June 5th, seeking change of use of existing dwelling house and ancillary domestic garage to a guest house accommodation at Trinret, Letterkenny. A newly formed residents association has been established in response to the proposed development. The group has lodged an objection to the plans with Donegal County Council. The chair of that group, Peter Patton, told the Donegal News that the group has asked many questions but has met with silence. "We want to know who's moving in," said Mr. Patton. "We've so many questions, but we aren't getting any answers. We've been given no clear picture of what the plans are." The Derry News this morning. Derry voters will go to the polls today to elect the city's MP. Polling stations are open from 7am until 10pm this evening. Counting of the votes will take place immediately after the polls closed. You'll need one of the following types of photo ID to vote: UK Irish or EEA driving licence, photo part, provisional accepted, UK Irish or EU passport. SDLP leader Colm Eastwood will face off against Sinn Féin's Sandra Duffy for the Foyle seat. Mr. Eastwood is defending a whopping 17,000 majority in what has traditionally been his party's... I can't read that word. His party's skitaddle? Okay, I must, I'm not familiar with that word. On to the Irish Times now, and buoyant tax returns fuel expectations of giveaway budgets. This is the Irish Times. I hope we're not on the brink of a major financial crash in this country. An awful lot of the rhetoric and conversation and spending feels very 2007-2008. But anyway, surging corporation and income tax receipts have boosted the state's financial provision, or position, sorry, handing the government the means to deliver a giveaway budget before the next general election. And I'll ask the question, this budget, as I did the last budget, we are going to see maybe a reduction in the hospitality tax down to 9% again. We are going to, as we heard from Alan Shatter yesterday, we are probably going to see changes to inheritance tax, and it's also likely that there will be more for people on a pension, which is good, I suppose. But would you prefer to see that money given away in little areas like that, or would you prefer it see properly invested in the improvement of services? Invested so that the likes of the Fáin Health Centre is not about to close. Invested so that iCare, Bluestack Foundation, don't have to constantly fundraise to provide essential services. Invested so that, you know, you might have to wait 3 or 4 hours in the hospital rather than as long as you might. Invested so that you can see a GP in a timely fashion. Invested so that you can go and get your teeth looked after with a medical card. You know, like, do you want to see these sort of high-profile giveaway things? And I think, you know, the standard of living in this country is better than in other countries, it has to be said. Or would you prefer to see this money targeted better to improve life more generally? Let us know, 086 60 25,000. But despite repeated warnings about the potential volatility of multinational profits, corporation tax receipts have continued to grow, with half-year Exchequer returns published yesterday showing that tax generated $5.9 billion in June, up by $1.6 billion or 38% on the same month last year. So in 1 month alone, in excess of €4.3 billion was gathered in corporation tax. $4 billion. Everyone's going on about the cost of this children's hospital, $2 or $3 billion, and I get that, right? But in 1 month alone, The government received unexpected corporation tax that dwarfed the cost of that hospital, which will provide essential treatment to children. Corporation tax receipts for the year now stand at $12.2 billion, up $1.6 billion on the same period last year. That's good money. I just don't think it should be used by any party and whoever was in government to sort of win an election. It just doesn't rest easy with me. That really kind of is our money. Labour set to surpass Blair's 1997 landslide as Tories face annihilation. I think Tories really what they're doing is facing a reset after all of they've been through over the last couple of years with the leadership, the fleeting leadership changes, Boris Johnson's leadership, everything that came with that. You know, I think British politics is kind of hitting a reset at the moment. I don't think the Tories, other than those that are going to lose their jobs, are going to be too worried about it because they need to rebuild. And you could see something similar wanting here. I do remember Leo Varadkar sort of thought before the last election, was it, that, you know, maybe a period of time in opposition for the likes of a Fine Gael, for an example, would give it a time to, you know, reset itself, its own identity and move forward. So it's not necessarily always a bad thing unless you are the person losing your job. Opinion polls show the centre-left Labour Party is set for a big win in today's vote that would end 14 years of Conservative government and hand Mr Starmer the keys to the Prime Minister's number 10 Downing Street office tomorrow. Keir Starmer is interesting. I don't really feel terribly engaged by him. So obviously his success will be as much down to the opposition, I think, as to him himself. Maybe that's not fair for me to say, but he doesn't strike me as the most, you know, striking of people. Both Mr Starmer and Conservative Prime Minister Rishi Sunak kicked off the last day of campaigning before polls open, warning voters of the dire economic consequences if the other man wins. Now, the difference in Britain compared to here in that we are heading into an election and we are heading into a retention or a change of government with actually quite buoyant finances. And I know people listening, not everyone feels that, but there is a lot of wiggle room in our finances. In Britain, post-Brexit, they really have no latitude. If they want to do anything at all, they have to borrow significantly or raise taxes. We have headspace here. There is zero headspace in Britain to try and improve the lives of people in that country. And most of it is down to the impacts of Brexit. And that just is a reality. The Irish Daily Mail this morning covers a very, very sad story, one which I actually haven't been able to fully read because it's just so upsetting. And it's the story of a mother and a daughter who had their dreams all cut short when they were among four people killed on our roads in just 24 hours. Aisling Moore, 46, and our beautiful wee daughter, 8-year-old Abigail Moore, died after the car they were travelling in collided with a lorry on Tuesday evening on the N26 at Lismore in Foxford in County Mayo. Another two men were killed in separate instances in County Westmeath. It's feared that one of those men, Marcini Nowalinski, 47, may have lain dead for days in his vehicle. It struck a ditch. And Aisling and her beautiful daughter, and she's a beautiful woman as well, Abigail, are pictured on the front of all the papers today. And both of them look absolutely stunning. And I don't mean that in the physical sense. I just mean that in the terms of the happiness human sense. And it looks like Abigail was making her first Holy Communion. And it is just beyond sad and beyond words. And I suppose if there's anything we can do, and not talk of those, not attributing any blame or cause to those collisions because the investigations haven't been concluded, but just driving up the road from Dublin yesterday, people driving unbelievable, some overtaking manoeuvres that were done, you were thinking, seriously, is this person on a death wish? And you know what? It's potentially in these collisions, it's not what they do and the impact it has on them, but some of the overtaking and near misses, it's the car that's coming in the opposite direction that they could drag into their dangerous driving and rob them of their lives or what have you. And it's just, you see it, you only have to travel up and down from Dublin. Firstly, didn't see a single guard. I'm not saying that's a good or a bad thing, but drove up and down from Dublin in the early afternoon and at night time. There was one speed van on a motorway. Now, motorways are the safest roads in the country. There's one speed van on the dual carriageway where the speed limit's 120 kilometres per hour. And that was it. No squad cars, no nothing. And I kind of was keeping an eye out to see what the crack was. Didn't see a single guard up and down in the one day, and one speed van, and that was sitting on the 120 kilometer stretch. Yet I saw, I would say, 5 or 6 dangerous driving instances, but 2 whereby it was like, you know, you slow down because you think you're about to see a crash. So, I mean, firstly, there's an issue with enforcement there, but secondly, driver responsibility, speeding, distracted driving, dangerous overtaking, particularly is what we saw yesterday. But anyway, we have to sort of take some responsibility in that area as well. The Irish Farmers Journal this morning, the 2024 weaning trade has opened with a bang in the south of the country, with 3 exporters locking horns in Leaver, Martin, Kerry on Tuesday. Live exporters snapped up over 60% of the weanlings on offer in Ivra, is it? Or Ivra? I beg your pardon, sorry for being so ignorant. With prices up 50 to 70 euro a head on the same sale last year. So that's good news for the farmers there. On to the Irish Daily Star now. And the mother of murdered Donegal backpacker Danielle McLaughlin has revealed she is nervous and scared over the verdict as the 7-year murder trial finally approaches its end. Danielle, who's 28, or was 28, from Buncrana, was found dead in a secluded spot in Kanakona, an area of Goa in India, popular with holiday makers, back on March 14th, 2017. The night before she was found dead, Danielle had attended a party near Kanakona Beach in the south of Goa. She had been brutally assaulted and murdered. Local man Vikat Bhagat has been charged with the rape and murder of Danielle. He's been in custody since 2017, and his trial, which started in July 2017, has been ongoing for nearly 7 years, making it one of the longest murder trials in the world, believe it or not. He's pleaded not guilty to charges of rape, murder, violent robbery, and destruction of evidence. And you just hope that there's an outcome to that, and as soon as is possible, because it's been going on and on and on. The Sun this morning, former DUP leader Geoffrey Donaldson has been sent for trial over 18 allegations of historical sex offences. So yesterday he was appearing in court, and where it'd be determined the next plan of action. So it is confirmed he's going to go to court. A district judge at Newry Magistrates Court said he was satisfied Mr. Donaldson, 61, and wife and co-accused Eleanor Donaldson, 58, had a case to answer. The couple will next appear at the Crown Court in Newry on September 10th for an arraignment hearing ahead of their trial. During the court appearance yesterday, Mr. Donaldson, sporting a beard, was asked if he wanted to say anything in answer to the charges. He responded, "No, not at this stage." He's accused of 1 charge of rape, 4 of gross indecency, and 13 charges of indecent assault. And normally you see him wearing a pin. I'm not sure if that has a religious connotation. I do note in his suit that pin today, or yesterday, sorry, is absent. And of course, lots of politics happening. Over in America, President Joe Biden last night vowed to keep running for re-election, hours after the White House slapped down reports he was considering quitting. Mr. Biden, who's 81, rejected pressure from within his Democratic Party to withdraw after his disastrous TV debate with Republican challenger Donald Trump, who's just 78. The president said he nearly fell asleep on the show due to travel exhaustion, and he vowed, "I'm running. I'm the leader of the Democratic Party. No one is pushing me out." So he admitted he nearly fell asleep standing up because he was so tired, though that travel was some time beforehand. Texas Congressman Lloyd Doggett became the first sitting Democrat to call for Biden to go. He's got an interview, I think, on Friday, a television interview on Friday, which will be quite critical. Now, I'm not sure how closely aligned he is to that network, so it could be massaged, let's say. But interesting times. Again, if I were a betting man, I don't think he'll be running for that party, but we shall see. So we've had a number of texts. Here's a couple of samples. Why are there so many lorries going off the road on the Lifford side of the Manor roundabout near the turn off to Dromahol and the Galdonna Road turnoff? There's been 2 in the last 2 weeks that I've seen, and another about 5 weeks ago. Something's wrong there. Another read as follows. There seems to be a lot of road traffic instances involving lorries recently, with 2 incidences in Donegal yesterday alone. Is this because there are more HGVs on the road, or because a lot of lorries are larger than they used to be, but the roads aren't getting any wider? So, as we always try and do, follow it up. Let's talk to those in the know to see what the story is. John McLaughlin is of JML Haulage. John, good morning to you. Thanks for taking the call today.
Morning, Greg. How are you?
I'm good. Right, John, I mean, there's a couple of things going on here. Sometimes there's a happenstance whereby we get a couple of incidents in short time, and then it kind of looks like a trend when it may not be. What's your take on that stretch of road and why we've seen a couple of instances of lorries going off the road recently?
Well, on that particular road, Greg, there has been one of the most dangerous roads in Donegal, to be honest with you, because there's that much traffic on it. But there's not that many lorries on it. There's actually less lorries on the road now than there was before. But what the problem is people passing lorries and overtaking. Lorries is only allowed to go at 50, 55 kilometres an hour, and they're chatting now about cutting that back again. And, like, everybody keeps saying, oh, cut down the speed. But if they cut it back anymore, the speed limits are on, and we bring the speed limits down now from 100 to 80, 80 to 60, 60 to 40. To me, there's going to be more deaths in the road, because that's what's going to happen, because people will not sit behind lorries. And like yourself yesterday, you were in Dublin. Mm. I had to go from Donegal to down to Shannon Airport. And yesterday alone, the amount of near misses that I've seen is unbelievable.
Talk to me a little bit about that, because I was taken aback. And as I said, John, you know, people can make personal decisions and all that type of stuff, but it's the innocents that often get caught up in these crazy driving behaviours. What did you see on the roads yesterday, John? And one example, by coincidence, both of us doing decent journeys yesterday. You're more used to it than I, of course.
Well, I've been on the road most days, nearly every day, to be honest with you. It's a truck or van or something. And yesterday, now in particular, I'd done nearly 603 miles from my left in 8.5 hours.
Wow.
And yesterday, there was one vehicle come across a white line into me yesterday, and it was 2 foot onto my side of the road. And, well, I don't know what he was doing, but definitely wasn't driving anyway, so...
What do you do in a situation like that? There, because
you can,
the seconds are short in terms of your reaction. Now you can't do a massive swerve in an articulated lorry because you could jackknife, go off the road or whatever. What do you do, like?
You can and you can't. It's reading the road in front of you, Greg. Yeah. As you said yesterday, you can see things, but a lot of people don't see them things, and that's what's wrong. I honestly think people going for tests should be on an anti-skid track for a few hours before they go for their test to learn them different things and how to go with their test. Mm. The same with trucks. I've always said trucks should have been fully loaded for to do their tests, because you get a new truck driver, a new car driver, anybody. It doesn't matter who they're, and they get into the vehicle for the first time. And one instance yesterday, there was an end plate. Yesterday, on 120 kilometres an hour, I was sitting at 120 kilometres an hour, but I think I was stopped whenever he passed me, and I caught up on him then later on, because he went under the services, now I went under the services to get a bottle of water, and I just noticed it was a young boy about 17, 18 years of age.
Mm.
Like, what is going on? Like,
just one thing, John, on the testing, which I think you're quite right in saying, because it doesn't really prepare for real-world driving, even in the cars.
No.
There's no testing at night, as far as I'm aware. If there's any frost or ice, the test's cancelled. If there's any snow, the test is cancelled. And there's no real provision to properly check how someone deals in the event of an emergency. Is there any conversation about a car, say, for instance, that has anti-lock brakes versus one that doesn't have anti-lock brakes? What you're supposed to do with the pedal? What way you're supposed to steer if you lose control of the car? I'll tell you the way I look at it, John, and maybe you're the same when you're driving, but certainly in the radio perspective here, if I'm training someone or I'm preparing something like an event like the elections or something, all the stuff I focus on is what to do when something goes wrong. Not when everything goes right, because that's fine. It's what do you do when something goes wrong? And in terms of a really interesting point you made, that the Arctics that people are doing the tests on, or the buses for that matter, or whatever it might be, they're completely empty for the lessons and then for the test. Also, there's no conversational training in what to do, say, for instance, in an emergency braking situation.
Well, I'll just give you one for instance. Way back about 15, 18 years ago, when I had 50-odd trucks, young boy come to me. Supposed to be a very good pilot, driving rigids for God knows how long, and he went and done his Arctic test. And so I said, right, okay. Something told me to go along with him for the run in the Arctic, so I went with him. Went down past me, Dave's garage. It was in full tilt. And what I mean by full tilt, it was on the limiter, like, and I thought, Jesus, this boy's either very good or else I'm something wrong. And it wasn't, it was halfway down the hill that I caught on there was something wrong. He just didn't comprehend the weight wow. of an Arctic and how to control it. And I swear to God, Greg, I just stood up in the middle of the lorry and I reached for the two shoulders and pulled them straight out of the seat. And only I'd done that, I probably wouldn't have been here the day.
Like, wow, so you had to literally jump in?
I had to jump in there and to go with the truck. Like.
Other than emergency services that were... Other than emergency services that were at the crashes, which I presume that you saw, or maybe it was the aftermath. But anyway, putting that to one side, did you encounter many guarded checkpoints or
no, I was laughing when you said you only seen one yesterday.
Yeah.
I seen none.
None.
Absolutely none. And I was very, very, very focused on a van or something. Very focused. And I seen nothing yesterday whatsoever.
So we did
Absolutely
about 1,100 miles together yesterday in different vehicles.
Yeah.
All over Ireland. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And I seen nothing. Absolutely nothing. Now, not to say that they weren't there at the times that I was going through, but and I don't hang about. I wasn't hanging about, but then I would be... I would put myself as a driver. Like I've rallied for 20 years. I've raced motorbikes. So I'm up there with fast reactions, if you like, for a better word. But no, today's car drivers, today's truck drivers, anybody new and all that, like they need to go through a different system. And now the trucks is not that serious. You can't get drivers. Nobody wants to come to them. It's impossible to get drivers. Mm. And now by the end of this year, they're checking it. They're changing all the tachographs now to go to smart meters, which is another 1,400 to 1,800 per truck that we all have to spend again by, I think, November, December this year, which is absolutely ridiculous for something that's only doing 50, 55 kilometres an hour.
And also, John, we talk about distracted driving too, and there's some amazing vehicles on the road now, but even, you know, your entry-level electric cars, a lot of them, almost the entire dashboard is taken up by screens, different screens doing different things. You know, and then people say, well, don't look down at your phone, and you should never look down at your phone. But it's like sitting in front of a 60-inch TV in some of these cars, not with TV on, but all the stuff that's on them. That's not really a conversation that's had, but it beggars belief. I'd love one, don't get me wrong, but people think I'm ignorant, but I'm very, very... I watch the road intensely, so people wave at me, and I don't wave back, and they think I'm ignorant, but I'm not.
I wouldn't take electric car free of charge, to be honest with you. I think they're dying out big time because they can't get the power points to charge them, and there's a whole lot of miscommunications going on there throughout Ireland at the moment, and not just Ireland, but in Britain as well, with electric cars. But yeah, there's too many gadgets, but the lorries nowadays, like, if I had to do an emergency stop now, I'll stop far faster than a car will stop.
Yeah.
You know, they're unbelievable what they can do now at the moment. The technology is phenomenal, and I have to take my hat off to them, like, but at the same time, it's just, we're only paid to do 8-9 hours a day, and that's getting enough for to cover the costs in that 8 or 9 hours a day. It's the cost of running trucks at the minute between diesel and insurance, tax, everything is just absolutely phenomenal. Phenomenal.
And
there's a lot of people getting out of the business as well.
Yeah, of course. And we saw then, you know, what was it, snow? There was a couple of days of snow, and we ran out of bread, we ran out of milk, we ran out of chickens, we ran out... You know, we do this, next day sort of supply chain, and as soon as the lorries were off the road... We're also panicking for bread. So really, just in relation to the finally in the Lifford Road, it's a narrow road, soft verges. Maybe drivers that aren't familiar might get caught out by that. And of course, then you have to factor in the behaviour of drivers coming in the opposite direction or overtaking.
Direction.
So it's kind of obvious what the problems are with that road, John, do you think?
Yeah, It is, yeah. And especially when you go further down and through the trees there, just the far side of Rafal, between Rafal and Lifford. Now, any time I go down there, it always scares me. I'm always, the hairs are standing on the back of my neck, because if you meet another lorry, I'm no joking, I swear to God, you only have about 3 inches between you and the other truck. Because the width of the truck and the width of the roads coming around them corners with them big high trees. And they started to take them away there about a year ago, and then they stopped. And I don't know why they stopped. And I don't know, I would say it's one of the most dangerous corners. There's that Lifford, that bit of stretch of road from Lifford to Letterkenny, there's definitely somebody going to get killed there very short.
God forbid. All definitely. Right, John, but you're a professional driver, so we have to heed your warnings too. Thanks for your time. Safe motoring. Take care. That's John McLaughlin of JML Haulage there. Any views on that? 086 60 25,000. A caller says it's clear the roads are too small and it's back up, and it backs up the argument on the need for a rail service. Another about the lorries on the road, the back road from Stranorlar to the Cross, the Arctic lorries fly down that road. They should not be allowed on the back road. Don't mind the milk tankers, as they have a need, but the Arctic lorries are just trying to miss the traffic in Ballybuffet by using the back road, a collision waiting to happen. The Dromahol Road needs a barrier. It's clear the verges are not able to hold big vehicles. Every councillor uses that road on a regular basis, so it's not like they don't see it themselves. Listening to Greg and your personal experience of the road yesterday, I think there is good PR exercise being done. The guards are just not on roads unless there is a rally. And I mean, like, it's not... A rank-and-file guard can't go in and go, right, this is what I'm going to do. But we were told that every guard now has to do half an hour roads policing, isn't it, or road traffic enforcement. Me and John there, between us, 1,100-odd miles together... I'm not exaggerating, by the way. I saw one squad car with blue lights coming up in the opposite direction on as we approached Dublin, and that was it, one speed van. And John saw nothing either. I'm not saying I want to see a plethora of them everywhere, but, you know, it's just the narrative. We're talking about an awful, tragic 24 hours and another awful, tragic 24 hours on our roads. And between me and John, zero enforcement or policing. They talk about these, you know, every Garda car now has a number, either does or will soon have number plate recognition technology. Unless they're all in unmarked vehicles, they're not going to be detecting anyone, because the cameras aren't pointed at any cars, certainly on the roads that me and John travelled, which is a pretty extensive trip. Hi, Greg. On the Friday morning of this year's rally, I was driving from Letterkenny to Ballyliffin for the golf at 9 a.m. and back in the afternoon. I didn't see one speed van or Garda representative during the trip. Considering the amount of potential speeders going to the rally stage in Carndonagh, I found this astounding. I saw a number of cars going well over 100 kilometres per hour. Letterkenny to Ballyliffin, is that not 80? Maybe it's not. Okay. I'm a lorry driver. Ask John, are the lorries going up to Dublin sitting at the 90 kilometre speed limit? Well, I was behind a couple of lorries that were 120 on the motorway. I'm not sure what their limit is there, and certainly 100 on the 100 area. Hi, Greg. Seen a nice photo of you in Dublin. Oh, thank you. That's lovely. Hi, Greg. I've seen a nice photo of you in Dublin. Oh, sorry, there's more here. And hands in the pockets, it's the height of bad manners. Sorry, I didn't see that last bit before I read it out. My apologies. It's a nervous thing. I get nervous. I put my hands in my pockets. You know what I mean? I'm it's just the type of me. Morning, Greg. Just like to know, where do the cans and bottles go to when we return them? Do they not be lifted by the waste companies? Thanks. No, they go to a particular recycling area, or I'm not even actually sure if that recycling area is built yet. But no, they don't go to the recycling companies. If you mean the recycling companies that collect the waste, let me read that again. Sorry, it's not the waste companies. Sorry, no, they don't go to the waste companies. That's why the waste companies are a little bit upset, because they're bypassed now, so to speak. Okay, let's take a quick break. We'll be right back on the 9 till noon show with our next guest. Although awareness of climate change is high among the Irish public, a sense of urgency about the issue and understanding of individual impact remains a challenge, this according to a new government report. The report highlights that a significant gap exists between climate intentions and climate actions amongst the public. So effectively, certain older people, are aware of the climate issue, but they don't want to give up the open fire. Younger people are aware of the climate issue, but they don't want to take less flights. That's the kind of stuff we're talking about here. John Gibbons is an environmental journalist and has been on the show before. We welcome him back. Good morning, John.
Morning, Greg.
Does anything about this report surprise you?
Not really. I suppose if we could break it down in all kinds of different ways, I could tell you the positive parts of it. I could tell you, for example, that 36% of the population, in other words, one in three people, so one in three people listening to us this morning, are classified as alarmed about the climate emergency, right? So that's quite something. That's one in three of the Irish population who realise that we're in an emergency. But what it also shows is how difficult it is to translate, I guess, intention into action. And we have a huge gap here between this. And I think a lot of it, Greg, has to do with the fact that people feel distance from it. And I think some of this has to do with our island status, the fact that we're a little bit away from things. We also, so far, have had a very, benign island climate, which is sort of moderated by the North Atlantic. So, for example, a couple of years ago, Britain burned up in 40-degree temperatures. It didn't reach here. On the other side of the Atlantic, they're getting battered by the earliest hurricane season in history. Across Asia, across parts of Europe, we're getting extreme flooding events. We're getting extreme heat waves, records being broken on a weekly basis. And much of this, we're watching it to some extent, but much of this, Greg, is happening. It appears to Irish people to be happening somewhere else and to other people. And frankly, we seem to be pretty happy that with that arrangement. In other words, we're not prepared to give things up, if you like, to reduce the suffering for people elsewhere. I think maybe that's a normal human reaction, but I think you described it, I think, very accurately, where on the one hand, we have a culture where young people are used to flying regularly. And in some cases, I'm sure many of your listeners will probably have taken maybe 10 or 20 flights in the last year. That's not at all unusual these days. Mm-hmm. And when they were asked about this in the survey, they said, well, you know, what about Taylor Swift? Right. So rather than comparing themselves with people living in sub-Saharan Africa, they're comparing themselves with billionaire celebrities.
Can I shift a little bit, though? And because I just wonder if we really need to change the conversation. And it's off the back of a conversation I had yesterday. You know, it's about, you know, us saying, well, are we really worried about what's happening in the rest of the world? Has the penny dropped here? I interviewed a skin expert yesterday, and it was in relation to a report that they had done, an extensive report, and it was in relation to the risks of skin cancer from sun exposure and sunbed exposure. And the survey found that the vast majority of people were fully aware that exposure to the sun, and particularly sunbeds, causes skin cancer. The biggest cancer in this country by a country mile. Yet 50% of them were still prepared to take on that risk to go on a sunbed, and a greater percentage were prepared to go outside and get a tan, even though that they accepted that scientifically it greatly improves increases their chances of getting the most prolific cancer in this country. So if people are prepared to make those decisions, even with the knowledge of the impact it could have on the health and what they go through, how far away are we from people in this country taking decisions to try and improve the life of people in Africa or in parts of Asia or elsewhere? Do you get where I'm coming from? There is such a gap between those two things. I can't see it ever being closed.
Yeah, I think that's a fair way of summarizing it. People are, I guess, they're looking, and some of it actually is really strange because, if you're asking people, for example, to go flight free, you know, you might say that's a big ask, maybe particularly for younger people. I get that they've grown up in a culture where that's what you do, and it's a difficult thing to ask. Some of the asks are really, really modest. For example, particularly among men, a good cohort of the men interviewed said there was no way, not that they would, that they wouldn't give up meat, Greg, they wouldn't even consider reducing meat consumption. Now, to use your health analogy, we know for a fact that Irish people, especially Irish men, overconsume meat. We consume meat beyond the level that is safe for our personal health. Yet, even though reducing your meat consumption, especially your red meat consumption, is good for your health and really, really good for the planet. Yet again, we see this reluctance. And people, in a sense, we're getting almost a little bit of the culture wars here, where people are seeing it as an attack on my freedom. You want to take something away from me. Yeah, we want to take away ill health and we want to take away planetary danger. Because the thing about planetary danger, I know it often sounds very, very obscure to be talking about things on a planetary level, but this planet is where we live. And this little island, we're as much connected to the safety and well-being of people in sub-Saharan Africa or in East Asia or in South or Central America as anywhere else. And I think closing that gap, Greg, that remains such an incredible challenge. Some of the other things that were looked at, for example, and this is maybe part of it is to do with the knowledge gap, right? People are saying that, well, for example, 1 in 8 people say that there is uncertainty among scientists that climate change is happening. Now, you know, and I know that that is completely wrong. It isn't an opinion. The scientific consensus on climate change being dangerous and being human caused is somewhere between 99 and 100% among publishing scientists. So unfortunately, people are getting misinformation, whether they're getting it through the media or through social media or through friend networks, it's hard to say. And that's one issue. That's 1 in 8.
Okay, so I get where you're coming from. But again, I'll go back to my point. If people want me to make decisions about their own health in the here and now, and for vanity reasons only, I do worry about the wider picture. Also, right, you see, I'll not talk about Taylor Swift, but, you know, I say I want to go home tonight and have a turf fire, for an example. I won't, but let's say I should. You know, I'm supposed to not do that. Yet over the next week, there's going to be towers of pallets lit on fire for cultural reasons across Northern Ireland and elsewhere. Plumes of smoke going into the sky and people standing around cheering and clapping. And then I say to myself, and I mean, maybe this is where the penny has to drop about personal responsibility. I'm saying to myself, though, you know, I don't have to use foreign examples or Taylor Swift or what's happening in Brazil or anything else. Like, why should I, you know, break away from my tradition when other traditions are celebrated and you can't say boo to a goose?
Yeah, that is the unpalatable truth, I guess, in Northern Ireland. That's for sure. I totally get that again. Where people are behaving in that particular case in a tribal manner, they're harping back to traditions and so on. I suppose the bit for me that is still missing in all of this, and this really, Greg, is the money shot in this whole process, is the understanding that our fate lies in our own hands, in the decisions that we make and the decisions that we don't make. I think a lot of us as individuals and as we're described as consumers, we feel kind of atomized, right? I hear arguments like, well, if you want me to do this, John, they'll just, you know, what about Brazil? What about China? What about America? Now, that is fine for people, especially for vested interests who want us to continue down this ruinous path. And it is a strange one, Greg, because if I were a vested interest, I'd like to think that I would say, OK, yes, I'm making a lot of money out of, you know, whether it's, you know, selling petrol or, you know, with selling red meat or whatever it is that I'm selling that is really high carbon impacts, you know. But I would like to think that I'm concerned, for example, about my kids and about my grandkids, that the world that they will have to live in. And therefore, that would temper my sort of selfish current behavior to think about the future. Okay. But as you've described with your analogy about the sunbeds, we have a very poor grasp of risk. We're not great at processing risk. And I'll give you another example, if I might. Surveys have been done asking people, are they an above average driver? Do you think you're an above average driver? And they found overwhelming majority of people, 90, 95% of people being interviewed, say, yes, I'm a better than average driver. In fact, I'm a very good driver. Now, of course, by definition, 95% of people can't be above average. We have all these built-in hidden biases, many of which, by the way, we're not even aware of. And they are basically telling us, yes, there's a little kind of noise, a little Jiminy Cricket in the back of our head going, this climate thing is really, really bad. But at the front, you have, you know, you have noisy politicians, you've got self-interested TDs, you've got vested interests saying, oh, don't mind them. That the it's only the green agenda. They're trying to take away our freedoms. It's an attack on us. Now, unfortunately, I wish it were the case. I honestly do. But the reality is that we either figure out how to change our systems or basically the whole thing goes down. And at the moment...
Yep. Yeah. Sorry, I have to leave it there, and we've a long way to go. Listen, John, thanks very much indeed for your time. I do appreciate it.
No problem.
Have a good day. Take care of yourself. All right, okay. That was John Gibbons, environmental journalist. This is the 9 till noon show. We'll be back with much more on the programme after we take a break.